Well, thank you very much for that special music. We appreciate that. And it's good to know that one half of that duet is going to be here with us.
I want to hear from you again. Definitely want to hear from you again. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to those of your guests and visitors. Glad to have you with us today. We've got a few people that are out, but hopefully we'll be back next Sabbath. And Weber's, as Mr. Gardenhire mentioned, will be gone for a couple of weeks. But next week, I think it's Mr. Howell and Mr. Larry Sharp will be speaking next week, so we look forward to hearing from them. I'm sure that you all have heard the statement, don't judge a book by its cover. That's not something I made up last night, saying it's been around for a long time, a lot of wisdom to it. But how many publishers do you think really believe that? You know, how many people get a book to publish, and they don't care anything about the dust cover? Now, they spend hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars a year trying to get just the right picture, just the right thing to catch your eye to help you to buy the book, make that choice to pay your hard-earned money for a book that you may or may not enjoy and get something out of. But nevertheless, they spend just literally hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars doing that. I know many of you probably don't read them. I have a full library of romance novels. I'm kidding, of course. But you know, you've seen the pictures on them, right? They found Fabio, the quintessential cover for romance novels. Big, beautiful, blonde, flowing hair, muscles. It looks like me when I was 20. Well, I had longer hair anyway. But, you know, they search for just the right image to put on that book to sell it. And the same thing happens in advertising. Marlboro didn't go find that cowboy for no reason, you know, to put him on the packs of, or the covers of their packs of cigarettes. And, of course, he later died of lung cancer, but he helped them sell. And first impressions. You know, they never say you get a second chance to make a first impression. And this all goes into the whole idea of impressing people. But let me ask you, just how quickly should we size up another person? Should we do it just on appearance? Should we do it just on things that we hear or may have heard about them? Or how quickly should we jump to conclusions about a particular matter that we may not have personally witnessed or have any firsthand knowledge of? How quickly should we judge someone because of a rumor that we heard about him or her? I think most of you know the answers to those questions, and most of us in this room are old enough to have made the mistake of coming to a conclusion about a person or some matter before we had all the facts, and later, you know, to be embarrassed to discover that we were totally wrong and didn't have all the information. It's a rather humbling experience, isn't it? Yes, it is. The Apostle James, in the second chapter of the book of James, gives us a warning based on partial information. In James chapter 2, the first 9 verses, he says, "My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality," that is, with favoritism and so forth. "If there should come a man into your assembly, a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should come also a poor man in filthy clothes, why," it says, "you pay attention to the one wearing the fine clothes and say to him, you sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, you stand there or sit here at my footstool down on the floor. You have not shown partiality, have you not shown partiality among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom of heaven," or the kingdom, he says here, "which he promised to those who love him? But you dishonored the poor man. Do not the rich oppress you and drag you into the court? Do they not blaspheme the noble name by which you are called? And if you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You do well. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors." So James warns us here about making judgments based on appearance, lack of total information. And in principle, this goes far beyond. In Proverbs 18, verse 13, It says, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it's folly and shame to him. Yeah, I agree with that. I like the way the Life Application Study Bible, which uses the New Living Translation, puts this. It says, spouting off without listen or before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish. And the Living Bible says, what a shame. Yes, how stupid to decide before knowing the facts. I want to talk with you today about not being too quick to come to conclusions. And I want to look at one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. It's the story of Job. But we're not going to focus on Job. So how do you go to Job and not focus on Job? Well, we're not going to. There's another character in the story whose name is not even told. It's really the story of Job's wife. So if you will, join me in the book of Job. It's the last book you've come to before coming to the Psalms. And we'll start right at the first of Job. And we've got to read a little bit here about Job to find out a few things about Mrs. Job, we'll call her. The Jews have a theory and an idea that Job's wife was Dinah, the son of Isaac and Jacob, but no real proof to that, so I'm not going to call her that today. We'll just call her Mrs. Job. It's good enough. Job was a descendant of Aram, the son of Shem, a son of Noah, and possibly a contemporary with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, as you may recall, was also a descendant of Shem, but through another line, or a line of another of Shem's sons, Arphaxad. There'll be a test on that later. A-R-P-H-A-X-A-D. Make sure you get it in your notes. No, you can look that in Genesis 11:11 if you like. But so they were probably distant cousins. It doesn't come into play in the scriptures, but just to kind of give you a feel for the man and a little bit of his background. And we begin here in Job 1, verse 1. It says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Now, Uz was a land that was down southeast of the Dead Sea. And back before there, of course, there was a country of Israel or Judah. And it goes on and says that man was blameless and upright. Notice it doesn't say sinless, and that word doesn't mean sinless, but he was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him, and also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 cattle, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. And so this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now, we read this and we typically apply that and think of that in its immediate context of Job, but this is actually a description of Job's family. I mean, they all shared in this wealth and this prestige and probably a very influential and powerful family in the region. If he was the greatest of all the men in the East, then his family was certainly sharing in his status and his prestige. And Job's greatness not only consisted of his wealth, but also of his moral and spiritual qualities. So it wasn't just the wealth, if you read on in the book, and I'm sure you have in the past, and we're not going to go through a lot of the book of Job today, but we're going to concentrate here in the first couple of chapters. But to keep in mind that everything that we read here about Job is applicable to Job's wife, and his children, his family, for that matter, as well. So let's continue on now. His sons, verse 4, would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. Now, this has been used many times in the past to say that they were celebrating their birthdays and to use as, you know, something against birthdays. And that really is not what is meant here at all. Both the Septuagint and the Moffat translations shows that they took turns having feasts and providing for their families at their houses and so forth. The Septuagint, a verse version of the Old Testament that was widely used in the early New Testament days and most often quoted in the New Testament, says, "And his sons visiting one another prepared a banquet every day, taking with them their three sisters to eat and drink with them." So they were a family, and they spent quality family time together. They were wealthy. They didn't have to go and slave and cook away, I'm sure. And they must have had servants to do much of for the preparation for the banquets and that they the feasts that they had. That some of the accoutrements that come with naturally with wealth and being able to do that. So verse 5 goes on, "It was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise up early in the morning and offer burnt sacrifice, or burnt offerings rather, according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' And thus Job did regularly." Now, this shows that Job was functioning as the priest of the family, which was a common thing back in those times before a priesthood and before the temple. And each head of household acted and functioned as a priest for the family. Another interesting thing here is the word cursed. Cursed. It said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Cursed, this particular word is translated cursed only 5 times in the whole Bible. And all 5 of them are in the book of Job. 5 times, far and away the most times the word is translated as blessed or blessing or bless. So, I mean, it's almost 2 sides of the same coin. And it takes a lot of context and so forth to determine which in particular is a proper translation. But it is, as I said, overwhelmingly translated as blessed. And I'm not saying that it should be blessed in this particular context in this verse, but I will make that point a little bit later on. Job then carried out and did these things because he was concerned that his family might have done something, maybe under the influence of the wine that they were having at their banquets or feasts, who knows? But he knew his children, I'm sure, and was trying to cover the bases. And then we come to verses 6 through 19, and you know the story, and I'll just summarize it. There was a day when Satan came before God, and God pointed out that Job was a servant of his and blameless and upright and so forth. And Satan said, well, you know, he does that not for no reason. You've got a hedge built around him. You've given him all the good things. And let me have at him for a while, and we'll see if he still blesses you or he curses you to your face. And so God gave him permission to do it. And beginning in verse 13, the calamities start to come. In verse 14, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were beside them. The Sabaeans raided and they took them all and they killed the servants that were watching after them. Another servant and runner came and told Job, verse 16, that fire fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants that were watching them and consumed them. And while he was still speaking, another came and said that the Chaldeans had raided the camels and taken them. So one by one, these possessions that were, of course, indicative of Job's wealth and made up much of his wealth, were being eliminated and taken from him. And then finally, in verse 18, another says he's just come from the house where his sons and daughters were, and there was a great wind, and it blew the corners of the house down, and the house fell on them and killed them, and he alone escaped to come and tell Job. Now, that was a quick bunch of calamities that I just went through. And I don't want to take anything away from them, but I didn't want to spend a great deal of time in them as well. So with all of this calamity on not only Job, remember, but his wife as well. All that wealth, all those possessions, those children were hers as well. It wasn't just Job that lost all of this. So what was Job's attitude? Well, we see in Job, in the first chapter here in verse 20, Job arose, he tore his robe, he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and he worshipped. He fell to the ground and he worshipped, and he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Blessed right there is the same word that we read earlier was translated as cursed. We wouldn't think that this would be what he would mean here. Cursed be the name of the Lord. Blessed would be the proper translation. And in all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. How could Job have had this kind of response? I mean, it's mind-boggling, is it not, to think that that much calamity came so quickly, so devastating, including not just the loss of his animals and his wealth, but of his children. I got a little bit of clue that I want to offer you. And I don't know this as a fact, but, you know, there are a number of books that have been written over the ages and through the years, at least, about the differences between men and women. There was a book called Men Are from Mars and Women Are from Venus. You may have read that. I read that book. It's kind of abstract. You got to read the whole book to really get the point. I found another book and came across it not long ago. It's called Men Are Like Waffles and Women Like Spaghetti. Concept is much simpler. I got it in the first two chapters. I'm not even planning on reading the rest of the book because I understand what the point is making. Now, there are exceptions to this. I'm going to speak generally. But men typically look at things in their lives as a waffle. And there's a box here, a square here, and a square here. And, you know, this one's for work, and this one's family, and this one's church, and this one's playing around, and this one's watching television and just vegging out. And it's a box that we may need. We need to go there quite often, ladies. But the boxes are all separate. And the things don't spill over. They don't get filled up and, you know, something from here spills over to there. I mean, it does a little, but not much. We pretty much compartmentalize and keep those things separate. We can be having trouble in one area of our lives and be just fine. You'd never know the difference in other areas. You ladies, on the other hand, are more like spaghetti. All your noodles are touching. Nothing's separate. Everything connects. You get a little something at church, somebody said something wrong, you go home and the family pays for it because it's related, it touched. It's all got spaghetti sauce on it. Waffles don't do like that. The syrup stays in this square until we want it to go to this square. Now, it's funny, but you recognize the truth of that, don't you? Most of us are like that. Not everybody, but most of us are. And I wonder if Job just didn't have that ability to keep that box where it was and not having that disaster to spill over to affect his relationship with God. Maybe that helped Job get through it. His wife, on the other hand, didn't. She got spaghetti and is all over everything. It just might be a part of the way that Job was able to handle it and continue to focus on his relationship with God. He continued to focus on his relationship with God and not give it up for 40-odd chapters. You can go on and read about that. But if you're like me over the years, you've heard the question posed. I'll pose it again. Was Job's wife a curse or a blessing to him? Was she a critic or a comfort to Job? Now, there's not much here to read about, is there, about her, as we'll see. I mean, if you're like me, you've probably heard over and over through the years a pretty much negative spin on Job's wife and an explanation of her role. I mean, how else could it be any other way? She says, Job, curse God and die. How could it be any other way? Well, Proverbs 18, verse 17 from the Living Bible says, any story sounds true until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight. So maybe there's another side to Mrs. Job. You may have heard the old Indian prayer, grant that I may not criticize my neighbor until I've walked a mile in his moccasins. A good idea. Go a ways, find out. Before we're too quick to criticize Job's wife, let's take a little walk in her moccasins, shall we? I've already explained to you that this, all this calamity that we read about didn't just happen to Job. She was right there along with him every step of the way, every pain and every ache of the way thus far. And she's only got one line of dialogue, one scene, and it's kind of a walk-on scene, if you would, if you're thinking of movies or a play. She's got a walk-on role, one line. Now, if you had only one line and one scene to contribute to the Bible, and I'm not saying that she knew ahead that this story was going to be recorded and, you know, Job's story and her part in it, but, I mean, wouldn't you want something to be memorable and have deep meaning to show what you were going through at that time? I mean, I think she was just being honest, as we're going to see, but you'd want it to be something that really stood out and reflected what you meant. Now, I'm reminded when I think of this being a one-line dialogue in the book, one scene, about, my memory may fail me a little bit, 20 years or so ago when, I'm going to go back into worldwide days here, but we had two large congregations, one in San Diego and one in Escondido, and usually about once a year, Escondido would have a talent show, and we in San Diego would have a fun show or a variety show. That was because they had most of the talent and we had most of the variety. And in one of those years, we put together a skit. We borrowed a skit. I directed this skit. And it came from somebody at a master college. They wrote it. They did it up there. I got a copy of it. We cast, you know, the people for it. It was to tell the truth. Do you remember the television story? Some of you, I know most of you are old enough to. Some of you may not be. But the premise of the show was that three people would come forward, all claimed to be the plumber, the doctor, the astronaut, the whatever. And so then there was a panel of celebrities, mid-level celebrities, I would think we'd think of it today, B-list or maybe C-list. Who was it? Orson Bean, Kitty Carlisle, and somebody else. I don't know. I think Gary Moore was the MC and the host. But at any rate, the panel would ask questions of the three people to try and figure out who was telling the truth. And so we had this little skit, and it was all about who was a member of the Church of God. So we had these three guys, and they had all come up and first of all say, "I am a member of the Church of God." Walk over to his table and sit down. Second guy, same thing. The third guy, and we did this, it was totally satirical, took all the stereotypes that we could with Church of God. So, the third guy comes up, and he's got a Bible in his hand and carrying a briefcase. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Because there was no role for anybody other than the MC, the three panelists, and the three contestants in the original script. Well, the wife of the guy who is coming with the briefcase and the Bible said, "Well, I think we could change this." "Well, I don't know how we're going to change that." And she said, "I'll come up with something." And so she created a role in our skit. Wasn't even a role to begin with. She made it up. We had no lines. She had no dialogue at all in the whole skit. And she stole the show. She stole the show. I mean, it was amazing. So, Emily, she borrows, Jessica was about 6 or 7 at the time, maybe 8. So she, another little girl was about 3, Chandler, I think. Ben and Paige DeMuth's little girl. And then we didn't risk having a baby, so we took a doll. So there were 3 kids, a mother, right behind Danny, who was playing this part. "I'm a member of the Church of God." Of course, he's got his Bible, he's got his briefcase, he's got his wife, he's got 3 kids. They've got a blanket rolled up, you know, so that she can put it on the floor. And they get over to the table where the 3 chairs are for the contestants, and there's no chair for her, you know. So she taps her husband, and you know, gets one of the stage hands, an usher, if you will, come and bring her a chair. Brings her a chair, and she sits down behind him dutifully, puts out her blanket. The children get down and begin to play and all. And she's got nothing in the script. And she says, "Keep your eye on me. I'm going to steal the show." And so that got it right away. I mean, everybody's got an eye on her. And then about halfway through, she gets up, picks up the baby, and walks this way between the table and the chairs, like she's going down the aisle, you know. She had nothing originally in this skit for this role, and she created it and did it all out of her own imagination. And it was fun, and it was really, really good. She made the most of something that wasn't even there to begin with. And the idea, first of all, was, oh, well, it'd be funny if, you know, if the wife and the children walk up with him. It kind of gives it away, obviously, doesn't it? But she made up these other things during this course of the skit. I've got it on VHS. If I can get it converted to DVD, maybe we'll bring it and play it after church sometime. The whole skit runs about 15 minutes. But it is satirical. It is funny. It is, anybody who has a history in Church of God will, you'll recognize everything in it. But my point was, there wasn't a role. She had no dialogue. Mrs. Job has got one scene, one line, two sentences, and she makes the most of it, I will contend with you. So, back to Job's wife. What message did she convey in her one line, in her one scene? We're in chapter 2 of Job now, and we're going to pick it up in verse 7, but just to get the context and pick up the context, Satan came back to God and told him, you know, well, I've done what I've done. And God says, well, how's he doing? And Job is still, verse 3 says, God says of his servant Job, there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man. He fears God, shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, even though you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. And Satan says, skin for skin. You haven't let me touch him yet. Let me add him. And God says, okay, you can do that, but spare his life. So we pick up the story in verse 7 of Job 2. And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the head of his, or the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd, it's a broken piece of pottery, with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And then his wife said to him, do you still hold on to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. It's rather mild rebuke, don't you think? Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, we've been taking a bit of a walk in Mrs. Job's moccasins, and I want to expand on that a little bit. She was obviously married to Job, the greatest man of the East, as we read earlier. And she, too, shared in Job's wealth, his status, his prestige, and likely in his moral and spiritual condition as well. A happy and successful family does not generally come from a home where there is a bitter, angry, contentious wife or mother. So, if this setting was what we read and think that it is because of Job's piety and relationship with God, then it's likely that she wasn't a big thorn in the side before either. And five times between the book of Genesis and Ephesians, we're told that when a man and a woman become married, they become as one flesh. They become as one. And as one, we share the same hopes, dreams, ambitions, the heights of joy and happiness, but also we share the depths, the disappointments, the discouragements, the hurts, and sometimes the suffering of one another. The vows, the wedding vows that many people take have that sentence in it, for better or for worse. There's a good reason for that. I understand Rush Limbaugh changed his to for better or better when he got married a few weeks ago. But that's kind of skirting the issue, isn't it? It's really for better or for worse, and sometimes it comes for worse. And for Mrs. Job, it had been good for a very long time. For a very long time, and then things got much worse. But godly couples pull together under stress and trial. And wives, you need to remember that your husbands need your support and affirmation more than they need it from anybody else. We can go through a lot if our woman is beside us and supporting us. And over the course of these several weeks, Job's condition had become so bad that he couldn't even live at home any longer. He just hurt. He stank. You know, these were days that there was no morphine, no Demerol, no Advil, not even an aspirin to help him ease his pain so that he might even sleep at night. She suffered each day as he did. Each morning and each night, suffering with and for her husband. She shared in the shame of the accusations that were made against him that all of this was because of some sin in his life. She shared in that as well. She suffered almost as much as Job did. And I say, you know, almost, except because it wasn't, her health wasn't involved as it was with Job's. But she too had lost everything, her home, her family, her possessions, her position in the community. She just didn't have sympathy with Job. She had empathy. Empathy. She knew personally and felt his pain. Because it was her pain too. And isn't it natural for us to want to relieve the pain and suffering of a loved one? I mean, if somebody you love is suffering and hurting, wouldn't you just give yourself to take part, at least part of that, to ease the pain of one that you know and that you love? I want to read the Septuagint part here, verses 7 through 10 of Job 2. The Septuagint actually, there must have been a different script writer because he's expanded Mrs. Job's dialogue beyond what was in the King James that I read you earlier. But it just goes to kind of highlight and enhance a little more of the point that I'm trying to make here. It says, beginning in verse 7, "So the devil went out from the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from his head to his feet. And he took a potsherd to throw away the discharge, and he sat on a dung heap outside the city." Out in the dung heap, in the waste, in the trash, in the dump. From being the greatest man in the East to sitting in the dump, scraping boils off of his body. And verse 9 says, "And when much time had passed, his wife said to him, 'How long will you hold out, saying, Behold, I wait yet a little while, expecting the hope of my deliverance. For behold, your memorial is abolished from the earth, even your sons and your daughters, the pangs and pains of my womb, which I bore in vain with sorrows. And you set yourself down to spend the nights in the open air among the corruption of worms. And I'm a wanderer," she says of herself, "I'm a wanderer and a servant." A woman had been practically queen of her society. She now is a wanderer and a servant from place to place and house to house, waiting for the setting of the sun, having to go and work for other people to make enough to eat and have a place to sleep. "At the setting of the sun, I wait for the setting of the sun that I may rest from my labors and my pangs which now beset me, but say some word against the Lord and die." And he looked at her and said to her, "You've spoken like one of the foolish women. If you've received good things, we've received good things from the Lord. Shall we not endure evil things?" I think that, as I mentioned earlier, that is a very mild rebuke if what she said was, "Curse God and die," or something like that. Let me read to you from the United Church of God Bible commentary on this section. Quote, "Once again, Satan comes upon an angelic presentation before God, and God presents him with Job's unswerving devotion. This time, Satan presses the issue by saying that if God will remove his protection and allow him to attack Job's physical health, Job will reject God, as he had predicted. God then allows the devil to cross that line, but demonstrating his power and authority over Satan, he still imposes a limit. Satan is not allowed to kill Job. Yet what Satan is allowed to do, afflict Job with painful boils from head to toe, was no doubt extremely and unrelentingly agonizing. And on top of the psychological pain of losing his family, it must have been all the more excruciating. Job's wife urges him to, quote, curse God and die, end quote, verse 9. And as I said here earlier, the word curse is actually the same word that's translated bless throughout much of the Old Testament. And it's only translated as cursed in Job. Coming back to the text now. Many today imagine her as an impious, unsympathetic, bitter nag, or even that she wanted to be rid of Job, thinking the loss of her children must have been his fault, that he had done something to deserve punishment from God. And I think that's kind of the traditional view many have taken about Mrs. Job. But the text goes on. But it seems more likely that Job's wife, having been so close to him and witnessing his unceasing devotion to God even now, would have perceived him just as God described him, as blameless. We should consider that besides losing her family, she was now watching her husband suffer intolerable pain and anguish. It was no doubt difficult for her to understand why God would allow her faithful husband to be stricken. Indeed, it's difficult for most people today to understand it. She may well have been quite angry with God. Moreover, she perhaps said what she did, thinking that Job's illness was terminal anyway and that he could, just with a few words, find immediate relief from his suffering. This great man, however, remarks on the foolishness of such a course and remains persistent in his faithfulness. End quote. When Mrs. Job had reached her limit of what she could watch her husband suffer, the husband whom she loved dearly, we look at what she said in verse 9 and think that it might well have read, instead of curse God and die, bless God and die. You're a man of God, you trust in God, bless God and die. As I read earlier, Proverbs 18:17 from the Living Bible, any story sounds true until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight. There's another side to Job, the story of Job's wife. She had endured her husband's affliction, even the loss of her children and all of her material possessions, and had survived these trials. And like her husband, she was bewildered amid so much calamity. So such a piece of advice that she gave him in his affliction could have been inspired by sympathy and love. And probably she would rather have seen him die than to continue to endure such great suffering. And though Job's wife is not mentioned in the closing chapters of the book of Job, we learn in chapter 42, verses 10 through 14, that three daughters were born to him as well as sons. And God blessed Job with twice the physical blessings that he had before. Probably Job's wife arose with new joy, as did Job when his trial was over. And she regretted her lack of faith when she advised him to bless God and die. She had almost as bad a time as Job. And maybe, if we think back to waffles and spaghetti, she might have had it even worse because every aspect of her life was touched, even her relationship with God. And Job maintained his integrity toward God. And in the end, she was blessed, as was Job, with the physical restoration of family and wealth, prestige, and relations with God. You know, the scripture says that God gave Job back twice what he had lost. And if you look and check and compare the number of animals and so forth that he lost and that was returned, they are indeed twice as much. If you look at the children that he lost, they're the same number. A testament to the fact of resurrection. That Job had not lost that family forever, but in the resurrection he would have those children. And he would have the other children that would place them in his life. So the lesson for us today should be obvious. What seems to be one way on the surface or at first glance may not be true, as I hope we've seen here in the story of Mrs. Job today. Take the time to get the facts before you come to conclusions. You may save yourself a lot of regret and embarrassment and quite possibly save the reputation of others by not spreading falsehoods about them. I hope that this other look at Mrs. Job and walking away in her moccasins to help you to understand that situation, that story, that example, and that we shouldn't jump to conclusions, even though something may appear to be clear cut. It doesn't always work out that way. Mr. Beatty.